meeting call order. And I will,
as we have a quorum, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the March 4th, 2009 meeting.
Madam Chair, I will move to approve those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Scott. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right. The first bill we have for consideration is House File 995. Representative Mullery, would you like to move your bill to get it for the committee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 995, and it would be referred to the General Register.
And Representative Mullery, you have an author's amendment labeled DE1.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I would also move that.
All right. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment?
Yes.
All right. All of those in favor of allowing said amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And that passes. All right, Representative Mullery, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just briefly go through the parts of it. The first section one deals with just clarifying last year's amendment in the statute, and it's to address a court decision holding the tenants who leased post-foreclosure sale were not entitled to the notice to vacate. Obviously, we want them to be entitled to that just as well as people who got the notice pre-foreclosure and pre-foreclosure sale. The second section, the first part clarifies that this section coincides with the deadline for providing the required notice of sale, and then the second part in that section two is just there was an inadvertent limitation on it by reference to 4720, which has some limits, but we wanted it to apply to all mortgages, and that was the intent of all of the people in our foreclosure working group from the year before last session, from the summer interim. Section three limits the data collection to residential property. Section four is actually one that came from a constituent of Representative McFarland. Oh, you are. I was looking around for you before you came. If you want to come up and just briefly, we're on section four, and that's one of the two parts where the date and time are in.
And that's from the Representative Carol McFarland?
Yes. Thank you, Representative McFarland.
That is to clarify that the notice that the owner gets contains the date and the time by which they must vacate. Currently, it's just saying like 180 days, and it's just clearing things up, making it easier for people.
And Madam Chair, that's also in Section 7. So the rest of the procedures, so that was Section 4. Section 5, we're just clarifying that the notice coincides with the deadline for providing the required notice of sale, and that's the same in Section, oh no, 6. Section 6 is the notice is to the property occupied by the tenants, and then 7 is the right, the additional language to take care of that issue that Representative McFarland brought up through her constituent. And then the Section 8 is Section, I believe 8 was the one we talked about. Section 9 just adds an affidavit in line 618 to 621, an affidavit that the foreclosing party provided all the required notices that we put in the statute by the terms of the working group last year, just an affidavit to put it on the record that is prima facie evidence of that. With that, I believe Kevin Dunleavy from the real property section of our association would like to speak.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Dunleavy, and can you state your full name for the record?
My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I'm co-chair of the legislative committee of the real property section of the State Bar Association. And I'm mostly here If there's any questions, I've looked at these, and several of them are corrections of things that I drafted in the last session, so I'm really in favor of those. Other than that, I'm available if there's any questions.
Thank you. Members, questions? Representative Holder.
Well, Madam Chair, it's a little unusual to go from a one-page bill with 10 or 11 words so I can go out mailing something to delete all of 6 pages in length. It doesn't seem that anything's too controversial in here. Is this information that's been in other bills, or is anybody opposed to this that you know of?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I think everybody that I know is supporting it.
Representative Holbert. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just as a clarification, Representative Holbert, these were all basically what was agreed to in that those 5 working groups that I had as part of the overall foreclosure working group, and people make mistakes when drafting technical real estate language, and that's just what happens, basically. And like I say, there's different places, different people found different items as to what was wrong. So when the bill first came in, then people said, well, there's this thing also that's wrong, and then there's this thing wrong. So it just kept going.
All right, thank you. Representative McFarland.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would also add that Section 4 and Section 7 are part of House File 1489 that I introduced today, and he just incorporated them as into his bill, which I approve of.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mulry, I'm kind of have some of the same concerns that Representative Holberg expressed. We really haven't had a chance, anybody on the committee, to evaluate these, and I know I talked to Mr. Elwood earlier, and he gave me a brief overview of what was the original bill, but have any of the landlords, lenders, others that might be affected by this, have they had a chance to review this amendment and take a look at it?
Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, it's my understanding Mr. Elwood will talk to that, but I think they all got copies of them.
Mr. Elwood, you want to identify yourself and
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. Representative Jaskowski, all of the there was a large group of stakeholders who participated in last year's working group that Representative Mullery convened, and they have all looked at this. These were shared with them. I have to say that when the original bill, as you pointed out, it was a small provision, and what had happened was, unfortunately, all these changes should probably have come a lot earlier, but the technicians, for whatever reason, they have other jobs, they don't work here, and so the folks that identified some of the technical concerns came to us a little late in the process, and that's why you're seeing this. This was the ideal vehicle because it changed the chapter of law that we're dealing with. It really was a furtherance of what we were doing last year, and this is the place to put it. But I think, your concern is well placed, but in terms of this being a big amendment to a small bill, but I can assure you that these are all technical things. They're necessary to clarify the law according to the real property section folks, and there's the folks who had a stake in it last year have all seen it and are fine with it.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having not been here last year, could you just clarify, would the Multi-Housing Association been party to that? And these changes that we received this morning at 10 o'clock, would they have received them about that same time then?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, the only one that really deals with the multi-housing is the first one. And they were very, very well aware of this. They're supportive of this. In fact, it's also contained in another bill that we're working on with them as well. So they have already seen this multiple times, are very comfortable. They were part of the group that put this in place last year.
Thank you, that's all.
Any other questions? I have one, and that is, I'm assuming that the additional information that can be handled by affidavits can simply be incorporated into one of the affidavits that exists and doesn't require a separate affidavit. Is that correct, Representative Mallory?
I think, Madam Chair, I think Mr. Dunleavy will probably be the one that works with the final way that's going to be handled by the real property section.
I think the intent of the legislation is that affidavit would get recorded with the sheriff's certificate along with some of the other affidavits, like the affidavits of service and publication.
As a single document?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, always trying to save fees. Now we're trying to...
trying to save recording fees. Any other questions? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify, either for or against this bill? Well, seeing no further discussion, Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 995 be passed as amended and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And the next bill we have for consideration is House File 84.
Madam Chair, I would move House File 84 for passage and re-referral to the General Register also.
Representative Mallory moved House File 84, and to your bill, Representative, tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a real simple bill. It just adds that a private action in under 325 F.69, which is the consumer fraud statute in Minnesota, is in the public interest and benefits the public. That was the way it was treated by everyone that I know of, including the courts and others, for decades. I believe the statute was first enacted in 1973, and I remember having cases under it, and everyone thought it applied. In fact, the appellate court in Love versus Amsler dealt with it as if it was individuals that could bring an action under it, and then a case, Levy-Nystrom, changed that, and there was a couple other cases in the country like that, and then shortly thereafter the legislatures changed their law back to clarify that it does. This is a consumer fraud statute, and basically right now you can't bring the private action under this without, as a consumer almost, you'd have to have a class action. And so we're just trying to correct that and get it back to the way it was always treated that way and the way almost all states treat it. We have with us today Professor Prentice Cox from the University of Minnesota Law School.
Professor Cox, would you like to identify yourself?
Gail
and welcome
Robinson.
To our committee.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't... Galen Robinson, I didn't see him.
All right.
Prentice Cox, Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. I've had a chance to write an article on this subject in 2006 and recently updated a book that I do on consumer fraud and had a chance to look at every case that's been decided since the Levy-Nystrom decision. In writing the article, I had the able research assistance of my then students and now your staff, Matt Geary. The result is stunning. Every individual loses. That's the result. The Supreme Court decision essentially means that if you're an individual, if you bring a consumer fraud claim, you're held not to have brought the claim in the public interest. There's no public benefit, and therefore an individual can't sue. I think we're up to 25 individuals' cases who've been reported that have been dismissed, which means that there's a larger factor than that of actual cases that have been dismissed. A second point, since the Levy-Nystrom decision, and particularly in the last 2 to 3 years, the federal courts have taken up this notion of a public benefit, in my opinion, utterly devoid of the statutory language, legislative history, or intent, and simply said, because there's this public benefit test, we'll now extend it and provide a second hurdle you have to overcome, and establish that, and establish that the remedy that is being sought is also in the public interest, even if there's more than one person, even if there's multiple people involved in the suit, even if the actual claim is based upon broadly distributed conduct. The remedy has to be in the public interest, and the remedy is not in the public interest unless the plaintiff seeks an injunction. So if you're just seeking damages for injury, which is in fact exactly what the private attorney general statute says you can do, that's not enough. You have to seek an injunction. Then it gets worse if the defendant says, but now I don't sell that product, or I promise not to do it anymore. The injunctive relief is mooted, and several cases have been dismissed because the defendant now says they won't do it anymore. It's getting increasingly harder. There is a group of investors who bought worthless debit notes and debitures mostly in greater Minnesota. They sued as a group. You would think that would satisfy the claim, but no. A recent federal court held that, in fact, that was insufficient because they were simply seeking money for themselves and hadn't established that there was a public benefit. So this doctrine has done, simply wiped out the ability of individuals to use this. If you've got somebody who's subject to mortgage fraud, this is Davis v. Bacon, an Eighth Circuit case, U.S. Bancorp, an Eighth Circuit case, it very clearly says, if you have an older person, say, who's been subject to predatory lending, oral misrepresentations, enters into a terrible loan, that person, that homeowner, cannot bring an action because they're simply an individual and it was just a one-on-one transaction. I think that is not what the language of the statute says. I don't think there's a purpose. And the last point I'll make is, I really don't see this as an ideological issue, as I've often testified here, and I know that it tends to break that way, but I'm kind of at a loss on this one, why anyone, no matter what your political perspective, would want this outcome. This forces plaintiffs to essentially file class actions or style their case as a class action in order to get heard under the Consumer Fraud Act. And that just makes no sense at all to me. I mean, I don't know why, regardless of your political perspective, you would want to achieve that result, which is not warranted by the language or purpose of the statute.
Thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Galen Robinson. I'm a litigation director with Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. I've been practicing consumer law since the beginning of time almost, at least 1980. And we see the effect of this. The majority of work we do is for individual clients, individual consumers. And as Professor Cox noted, the only way anyone can bring a consumer fraud claim with the current barriers is if you bring a class action, and that's inefficient in the majority of these cases. And the end result is we see a number of consumers who simply, they've been deceived. The whole purpose of the statute was to give them a cause of action so that they could recover for that, but they can't, because they can't show it's a public purpose if they're filing it on their own behalf in any form.
Members, any questions for any of our testifiers? Representative Hortman.
Just a comment. I'm a co-author, and so I hope members will support the bill, but I just have to note that with my 1L legal writing instructor and my first boss as a licensed attorney, as the witnesses for the bill, I have no choice but to vote for this bill.
I should probably disclose that your counsel also works with us.
I should probably disclose your grade, Representative. It would make other people feel good about you. Yeah.
I have never seen so much red ink in my life.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, I have a question. Could I get a question in the grades? Are we under oath here?
Madam Chair, I have to disclose that since Galen Robinson said he started consumer law almost at the beginning of time, I was before him.
Before the beginning of time. All right. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't know who this question is for, but I guess I've got two questions. The first is, will this, if this bill is adopted into law, increase litigation and increase the loads on our courts? And the second is, what are the other alternatives, avenues for relief for people who may seek this type of relief should we enact this into law?
I can take a stab at some of that. Right now, the other avenues for our clients aren't very many. There aren't very many attorneys who can help them. The Consumer Fraud Act was designed to prevent deceptive practices. The only other remedy for someone who's truly been deceived that is very viable would be to bring a fraud claim, but fraud is extremely hard to prove. You have to get into intent, you have to get into knowledge, and most consumers do not know or do not have the proof for that. They can prove they were deceived, but proving that all of the other elements is very difficult. Again, the whole purpose of the statute was to eliminate deceptive practices and to enable individuals to bring claims under the Private Attorney General statute as they had them. In terms of would it have effect on the courts, we had a clerk look at the number of cases that were filed before the decision in Levy-Nystrom. It's just a sample. They went through, I forget how many, I think they did a random sample of 2,000 filings in the year before in Hennepin County, pulled up 200 of those cases. And do you have the results of that?
I think there were only two that alleged the action under that, and maybe two as a counterclaim or something. Basically, you still have a contract action without this, but the problem is when there's fraud, we're trying to make sure that people don't get away with it, and that's why we're doing this.
Can I also add two quick things? Madam Chair, Representative, the analogous common law action would be a common law fraud action. There are two problems with common law fraud action. One is the Private Attorney General statute was passed in order to provide attorneys that most of these actions, there's simply not enough money if the prevailing party who can establish in a court of law deception doesn't have an attorney. Second, the limit on common law fraud includes a requirement that the plaintiff prove justifiable reliance. The courts for a long time have held and still hold that if there is a contract that contradicts an oral misrepresentation, even if the oral representation is false, that as a matter of law, the plaintiff could not have justifiably relied. So, in the Davis case, for instance, the allegation was that the mortgage broker made false and misleading statements to the homeowner. There have been a series of these cases involving mortgages, cars, or something. And if the statements made were contradicted by the boilerplate language in the contract, there's no common law fraud claim. However, under the Consumer Fraud Act, which is broader, there would be a claim for oral misrepresentations, even if there's contradictory contract language.
Any other questions? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify, either in favor of or against the bill? Brad Boyd. All right. Come on up, gentlemen, if you could allow these testifiers some space.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Brad Boyd. I'm legal counsel for the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and we're here to speak in opposition to the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Boyd, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With due respect to Representative Mullery and to Prentice Cox, whose treatise on this subject is certainly extremely informative and well-written, there are several issues that need to be pointed out for the committee's benefit to identify why there is some concern with moving forward with the legislation as drafted. First, the points you've heard articulated thus far tend to focus on the Consumer Fraud Act and saying that there should be some presumption that everything brought under the Consumer Fraud Act is inherently in the public benefit and in the public interest and benefits the public. And that's just inherently a flawed premise to begin with. What we're really talking about isn't just the Consumer Fraud Act of 325F.69. What we're talking about is can be private right of action under the Attorney General statute with attorney fees allowable to the plaintiff be reached. Right now, any individual, whether it's you or I or anyone in this room, if we're defrauded under the Consumer Fraud Act, we can bring our action, and if we prevail, we can be awarded damages. So if I give you an example, let's say you have a roofing contractor who markets that he can do a complete roof replacement on any home within the area for a fee of $5,000, and 100 people contract for his services. And in all those examples, he ends up doing a partial roof replacement rather than a total roof replacement. There's some misrepresentation, obviously, and there's some fraud. If it's affected 100 people, then obviously the Attorney General's office may be interested in such an action because they may want to, A, enjoin him from doing that, stopping him from ever selling that service and failing to deliver, and B, they may want damages to be awarded to the aggrieved or injured party. Right now, if any of those 100 people wanted to take that action up, they can do so under 325F.69, and then they can ask the court to allow their attorney's fees as a remedy under the private attorney general's right of action. And it, what we're really talking about is creating a public interest element in 325F69, the Consumer Fraud Act. What that would ultimately mean is now attorney's fees are automatically awarded by default. It's as if the Attorney General's office would take up each of those actions, regardless of whether it affected one person or 100. Just to draw a contrast to the example I just gave you, rather than a roofing contractor, let's say I was selling you a home, and in that sale, we started negotiating about price terms, and you were getting a little uncomfortable with the sale cost. If I were to tell you, the house has a $10,000 drain tile system that was installed last year, in order to assuage any concerns you'd have about moisture intrusion or water damage. That might be a fraud if I never installed a drain tile system. And the sale of merchandise under the Consumer Fraud Act includes the sale of real estate. So if I were to sell you that home and create that fraud with you, you could pursue me for damages under 325F69, the Consumer Fraud Act. However, in order for you to get your attorney's fees, which would otherwise be your responsibility to cover, anytime a private litigant brings an action against another, they have to pay their own freight. It's called the American rule. It's kind of the bedrock of our American jurisprudential system. If you were to want to recover your attorney's fees, the only way you could do that is to currently bring a prayer for relief under 831, asking that your attorney's fees be awarded, because this is something the Attorney General's office otherwise would have stepped into, and you're taking their shoes and ultimately asking that because this has some sort of public benefit, your attorney's fees be awarded. Clearly, in the roofing contractor example, there is some public benefit. Clearly, in the example I just cited you, where I'm selling you a house and you're buying it, there's far less public benefit because I may not ever sell a house again. It may be an individual transaction and not a public one.
Thanks, Mr. Boyd. Next testifier, Tom Hesse.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm not sure exactly how much more I can add to the testimony of the previous witness, but the Minnesota Chamber does oppose House File 84. We do appreciate the fact that it's a little bit more narrow than last year's legislation, but we believe that it will have generally the same practical effect of last year's bill. And as was previously stated, my understanding is that the award of attorney's fees is only permitted when the consumer fraud is to the public rather than to the individual. And in our view, it doesn't make as much sense to expand the plaintiff's remedies by being able to shift the burden for attorney's fees if the action involves only a single plaintiff. Doing so will tend to encourage questionable lawsuits and in the hopes of the defendant will settle to avoid the protracted litigation. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Oh, thank you, Mr. Hatchie. We have a third testifier. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Jaskowski, did you have a question for Mr. Hesse?
I did, Madam Chair. Thank you. For Mr. Hesse or maybe Mr. Boyd, I was trying to follow you, Mr. Boyd, but were you saying that that passing this would open up the possibility or potential for fraudulent suits claiming that they were being treated fraudulently?
I think it Madam Chair, may I answer that question?
Yes, Mr. Gordon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, I certainly do believe that it increases the likelihood that increased litigation may ensue by way of this change. Your previous question, I thought, was an excellent one, went to whether this would increase burden or cost in the court system, and I think the answer to that from our perspective is a resounding yes. I think what you've got right now is each plaintiff who has been defrauded under the Consumer Fraud Act has to measure and determine in their own mind as to whether their claim has sufficient merit to warrant their spending their own money to advance their claim to the court. And in the event they believe that the public has been harmed and that this individual wrongdoer needs to be enjoined or stopped from doing it, they can already pursue their action and then ask for the court to look to 831, the Attorney General's right of action, to enjoin the action from occurring by that wrongdoer any further, and to separately ask that their attorney's fees get recovered. I think one unintended consequence that I'd like to cite to the committee is that in the event this bill is passed, you've inherently presumed a public purpose in every Consumer Fraud Act action, and what that could mean is that, I give you just one more hypothetical because I think it helps draw a little bit of clarity to this. If you were to sell me a lawnmower for $750 and you said it had a brand new engine and you defrauded me, if that lawnmower fails and I later find out it did not have a brand new engine, I could sue you for the $750. And because the amount in controversy is so low, currently we'd ordinarily go to conciliation court, small claims court, in order for me to obtain that award of $750 from you. What this would actually encourage, that I don't think anybody's spoken to this point, is it would encourage me to now pursue that action under the Consumer Fraud Act and ask for relief under the Attorney General's private right of action so I could receive my attorney's fees. In effect, what that would mean is in my lawsuit against you for $750, I may incur $10,000 in legal fees taking it to district court rather than the conciliation court. So I'm abusing the system, not going to the more efficient and effective conciliation court. I'd be taking it to district court, doing discovery, doing depositions, all sorts of additional drawn-out processes that are really not intended for a $750 amount in controversy. Now, if I incur $10,000 in costs and you incur $10,000 in costs, this $750 amount in controversy has blossomed into a $20,750 claim. And what that can ultimately do is be an abuse process by plaintiff's attorney. Any brazen plaintiff's attorney may use that manipulatively and ultimately say, let's settle this claim for $2,000 rather than me incurring costs that you're ultimately going to have to pay for your client, the defendant.
Mr. Boyd, if an aggrieved plaintiff who has been defrauded gets Lindsay Conciliation Court action, one might argue that's a savings, but is it true that the defendant who just lost could simply appeal for a trial de novo and be right back in the system again?
I'm sorry, you're asking if they had gone through Conciliation Court?
Correct.
I guess my concern was that they would circumvent going to conciliation court altogether. They may bring their claim in district court, bypassing conciliation court in the hopes that they may be able to be entitled to attorney's fees using that process abusively to add the amount of cost that the defendant could incur in the hopes of you know, bargaining and getting a greater settlement. That is a dramatic example, obviously, and perhaps one that's not practical in the real world. I will grant you that, certainly.
My
but
point.
I drew that example out just to identify that there could be unintended consequences that we have not anticipated at this point.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Boyd or Mr. Hesse? Otherwise, please, our third testifier, identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. James Clark with MALA, Minnesotans Against Lawsuit Abuse. Madam Chair, I do have a small handout that I'd like to ask if that could be distributed to the committee.
Certainly.
Thank you. Madam Chair, MALA is a group of consumers, businesses, and trade associations that is united in highlighting the impact of Minnesota's civil justice system on consumers and Minnesota jobs. And we respectively oppose House File 84. It's been mentioned before many of the reasons why House File 84 is problematic. But the bill, by deeming violations of the Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act to be in the public interest, effectively expands Minnesota Statute 8.31, which is the private attorney general statute. And the significance that has been already pointed out would be to allow for the recovery of attorney's fees and other costs for individual claims of Minnesota's Consumer Fraud Act. The court in Davis v. Bancorp cites Minnesota Supreme Court in Lively Nystrom that private actions could be brought under the Minnesota Private Attorney General statute only if they benefit the public. And they also stated that litigation over an alleged misrepresentation that was made only to one person does not advance state interest. So if an action only involves a single plaintiff's impact by defendant's conduct, it doesn't make sense to expand the plaintiff's remedies by shifting the burden of attorney's fees. And the concern is that this will lead to more lawsuits, as was just discussed, and burdening the court system, as Representative Drazkowski pointed out, and encourage questionable lawsuits in the hopes that the defendant will settle to avoid paying the plaintiff's attorney's fees. The concern also is that businesses will face more unnecessary litigation and that those expenses will be passed on to consumers. There was a question earlier about the impact on the courts, and there was a not the same language, but a similar bill was introduced last year, and I believe the fiscal note on that bill was approximately $800,000. Now, this bill has been narrowed. The scope is narrowed. It no longer talks about all consumer protection statutes, but I think that it is what you're going to see is on any consumer fraud or any consumer fraud claim, you are going to have a or any consumer protection claim, you're going to have a consumer fraud component or count included in that claim. So I think you are going to pull in more cases than merely what this bill is intended to address. So for those reasons, MALA, Minnesotans Against Lawsuit Abuse, respectfully oppose House File 84.
Members, questions?
Van to testify? I have a question probably for you, Mr. Boyd. Isn't it true that the attorney's fees will be awarded only in those cases where the plaintiff litigates successfully and actually proves he or she was defrauded? Attorney's fees are not paid if there is a out-of-court settlement or if the plaintiff loses because the plaintiff could not prove that. Isn't that the case?
You're absolutely correct, Manager.
So then we are really only paying attorney's fees when someone has really been aggrieved and defrauded.
Correct.
All right.
And can I further extend on that for a moment?
You may.
The issue is that that currently, anybody who has been defrauded can recover their damages. And currently, anybody who's injured in an accident or has any other private lawsuit has to bring that lawsuit and pay their own way. Well, what this would extend into is identifying that every consumer fraud act is now in the public interest, whether it in fact is something that affects the public at large or just simply an individual. Our position is if it affects simply an individual, that individual should bring their claim individually at their own cost rather than presuming it's in the public interest and then taking advantage of the Attorney General's right of action in order to seek their attorney fees.
Any other questions? Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, addressing the small claims example, at a minimum, is there a way to write it, or do you think that the bill could be modified to only address claims that haven't gone, that were tried in small claims if they're under the $7,500 cap, or hopefully $12,000 if we get it changed? I mean, is there a way to limit it so you can't have that scenario? Just because, to your point, if people go through small claims, the rate of appeal is single digits. It's not double digits. It's not 100%. And so I'm wondering if there's a way to, at a minimum, tighten it up that way. Representative Mulray, maybe you have a comment on that as well.
Representative Mulray? Representative Westrom may need to repeat his question about conciliation court. Can you?
Well, maybe to the Mr. Hesse or one of the witnesses first.
Sorry, Mr. Hesse. If anyone wants to take a stab at that, go ahead, Mr. Boyd.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a very fair question. I think it's a reasonable point, and to the extent this bill were enacted as proposed, certainly modification would be wise and prudent to modify it as you suggest, that any action that is under $7,500 or less currently for the conciliation court claim amount would not be afforded the same opportunity to pursue the Consumer Fraud Act in conjunction with 831 and recover attorney's fees. I think that would be a prudent consideration.
Any other questions?
Well, Representative Mullery.
Representative what?
To the extent I need to re-ask it, I guess, is that something you'd consider carving out or making sure that we aren't intentionally putting more burden on the court systems by shifting an incentive for the plaintiffs to not resolve it in small claims court, and therefore people potentially going to the district court because they can get attorney's fees and also use that as leverage and maybe get more than they've got coming right up front?
Madam Chair, I was going to answer that when we came back, and I thought you were going to answer all of their questions them first, and then come back, and I want to get into the reality of this whole discussion.
Right, and I'd like to give you the last word on your bill. Yes. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. It's gotten really out of the world of reality. The fact is that this is the law for 30 years, what we're doing here. If all of these people were so concerned over 30 years of it happening, why did they never come to the legislature to change it if there were all of these horrible things that they're saying are going to happen? Obviously, they weren't happening, and they didn't happen in 30 years, and they're not going to happen all of a sudden. The real world is that in Minnesota, you don't get attorney's fees from judges unless you have a very good cause to get them. It's not automatic, and it's also up to the court. In fact, in Love v. Hansler case, the court, which was a first appellate case, I believe, on this statute, roughly mid-80s, there was an award of zero attorney's fees. And the appellate court says, well, technically, in this case, since you did prove fraud, there are attorney's fees, and I think it went back to the district court, and I think they gave $100. So don't count on a lot of attorney's fees happening. The reality is that there's no scary thing here. It's not going to encourage a lot of lawsuits. The fact is, as we indicated, we had 200 cases pulled at random in Hennepin County, and there was no case brought just on this issue. I believe it was two cases out of 200 where there was even alleged as part of the cause of action, and the cases would have been brought anyhow, I believe, on contract, both of them. There was also two cases brought as a counterclaim where it was mentioned, but the case was there anyhow in the courts. So it doesn't exist. I asked Gary Carter about it, and he called over, and the court said that there was no fiscal note needed on either of my bills today. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. In fact, I think Mr. Boyd acted said it's not practical in the real world that somebody's going to go to court and hope to get $10,000. That just doesn't make any sense for $750. Because the courts just don't allow attorney's fees. It's up to the court, and it's reasonable attorney's fees. And normally, if you've been there, you don't get what the amount of your attorney's fees are, even if you're awarded attorney's fees on these. Let's see, some of the other things. I happen to think, despite what certain people may think, but I think stopping fraud is in the interest of the state. And you've got to remember that these cases often may be brought on a contract and also consumer fraud. If you don't prove the consumer fraud and win the contract case, you don't get your attorney's fees. So the American rule still prevails in that case. Mr. Robinson or Mr. Cox also wanted to explain some things about this.
Professor Cox?
Madam Chair, thank you. I agree with what Representative Mullery said. Real quickly, there were essentially two points. One was that Mr. Boyd had mentioned that you still have a right under V.V. Nystrom to bring a consumer fraud suit. You just can't get attorney's fees. That's dead wrong. I don't know that there's kind of a myth that's been perpetuated on that. There is a case, Evangelical Lutheran Church versus Spirion. The church was lied to about, allegedly lied to about the services that it would be provided under an agreement, brought a claim that involved the Consumer Fraud Act. The defendant, the plaintiff alleged, well, we still have a right to a consumer fraud action, even if we can't get attorney's fees, and the court said properly, which is I think the only way you can read Lee, that no, this is a bar to bringing a suit under the Consumer Fraud Act. This is not just a bar to attorney's fees. The cite on that is 2005 Westlaw 1041487, for those who want to look it up. The second point was about the burden on the courts. And in addition to all the points that Representative Mullery made, which I think are correct, I will just note that the National Consumer Law Center came out with a report last month rating the consumer protection and what's called UDAP. These are unfair and deceptive acts and practices statutes in the 50 states. And Minnesota was singled out with a few other states for having one of the worst consumer fraud protection in the nation because of this problem. It is essentially, let's just lay it on the line what's happened. If you are an individual, you no longer have the right to a suit. And the National Consumer Law Center singled out this state as having one of the worst laws in the country because of the development of this law in the last 10 years. That's in contrast to the New York Times editorial about our anti-predatory lending law in 2007, where it said that the federal government should enact Minnesota's model predatory lending law that Representative Hillstrom was, I believe, the author of. In the House.
Thank you, Professor Cox. We do have to move the hearing along. I will take questions. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if the witness maybe could answer this or staff. Currently, if you write in a contract that whether it's a I don't know, you're selling a vehicle or a lease, and it's got the standard attorney's fees clause if the prevailing party shall get attorney's fees, et cetera, et cetera. What does that lead to? As I recall, there's a statute on the books that basically trumps or caps any of those recoveries at just a couple hundred bucks, but my remembering correctly, or if somebody writes that in their contract, do they get unlimited attorney fees if they prevail? And if you don't know, maybe staff does.
Ask Mr. Robinson.
Yeah, I'll try to address it in general. First of all, most of the contracts we see don't say the winner gets attorney fees, but rather it says we're selling this to you, and if we sue you, we can get our attorney fees. There's really a nice, friendly contract that says every one of us can collect. The second thing is, again, and this was talked about before, you have to win, if there is a statute or if there is a provision that provides for attorney's fees, you have to win. You have to convince the court that your hourly rate is reasonable and that the amount of time you put into the case is reasonable, and the courts weigh that. So it's going to be the court that's going to decide whether or not this was a frivolous case that shouldn't have been brought for the amount of time that was spent on it or not, but we don't see provisions that say either party can collect attorney fees, just in general.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, well, Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
I'm hoping this might be your last, and we have one more bill today.
Well, I don't know that I got my answer. Maybe Mr. Gehring knows the answer. If there's a clause like that, maybe you do, Madam Chair. I thought there's a statute that caps attorney fees right now. If it's not, I'm not talking a statute that provides attorney fees, but if a contract, just standard contract between individuals says the prevailing party or whoever's contract it is, if I have to sue you for it, I get my attorney's fees. Is that, Mr. Gehring, does that ring a bell with you or not?
Well, he's looking. I am not aware. I've never seen a cap I also, in 24 years, have seen a single award of attorney fees, so it's not very often.
Yeah, okay.
Any questions? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 84 be passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
I believe motion carries.
Oh, so you want to duck out? Ask Aaron. I don't know what to do.
The family tree is a mystery, so...
Welcome, Representative Murphy, and let's see, does somebody want to move the bill? Representative Hilton moves House File 328, and it's been to Health and Human Services.
I believe it will go to Health and Human Services Finance.
So it goes to the Finance Committee?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you, Representative Murphy. And Representative Helfer moves House File 328 for passage and re-referral to the Finance Committee. We can't distinguish where it goes.
I want to thank you very much for having us and for scheduling the hearing. I'd like to thank the both parents, the adoptive parents, and adoptees who are with us today, and I'd like to thank the many members who've signed on to support this bill. I really appreciate that. House File 328 modifies and recodifies the law governing access to birth record information by adopted persons. You good? Under current law, the right of the adopted person to have access to birth record information depends on when the adoption took place. For adoptions occurring before August 1, 1977, the general rule is the adoptive person does not have access to birth record information without the consent of the birth parent. For adoptions occurring on or after August 1, 1977, adoptive persons age 19 or older have access to the information unless the birth parent has filed an affidavit stating that the information may not be disclosed. This bill would change the law to eliminate the distinction between pre- and post-1977 adoptions. In all cases, an adoptive person would have access to a birth record unless there was an affidavit of non-disclosure on file with the state registrar, providing adopted persons with the same rights as their counterparts who are raised in their biological families as a matter of legal equality, ethical practice, and basic fairness, and I urge your support of the bill. And before I turn this over to the many witnesses and the lawyers that are here, I do want to share with you that I made a misstatement in the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Mary Little and I, and Representative Holberg, and I spoke about this today. I read from a letter that was given to me that had been sent to the governor, and it made reference to court cases, including reference to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. After the hearing, I learned that the reference in the letter was about the South Carolina Supreme Court. I went back to, actually it's South Carolina and I have the case with me. I have the cases if you'd like to read them. I went to my chair, I explained to him my error, he absolved me of my sin, and I shared the information as well with Representative Emmer because it was an issue of great importance to him. I want that on the record so that you understand that I am trying to be as clear as I can about this issue. There are many states that are dealing with it, many courts that are dealing with it, and the lawyers that are here with us today are going to be able to explain that better than I. With that, I'd like to turn this over to our guests, and they're going to share with you a little bit of information to try and make this as clear as they can for you, because it is a little bit confusing. And then there'll be lawyers here to answer questions. We'll take your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I think there's nobody here that hasn't made a mistake at some time. Would you introduce your testifiers?
Hello, my name is Carrie Blasner. I'm a master's in social work. I am currently a clinical social worker in healthcare. I'm also an adopted adult.
My name is Kate Ingalls Maloney. I am an education specialist, currently working as a consultant. I am also an adoptee, adopted in Minnesota in the 1950s.
Okay, thank you. As Ms. Waitsner, are you first?
Or? Waitsner.
Waitsner?
No? Blasner, B as in boy.
Oh!
E-S-E-N-E-R.
Okay, go ahead.
We have prepared an educational presentation for you that will be a PowerPoint presentation, which will then be followed by an attorney.
And I just want to mention that we do have some video in here. Some comes from a New Jersey hearing, and then some from Fox 9 News here in Minneapolis. So if the technology fails, we'll be test-counting for you. Here we go. All righty.
Your family tree is a mystery, so are many of the most important questions of your life. How healthy am I likely to be? Will I live long enough to know my grandchildren? And is there anything I can do about it? Knowing, for example, that cancer runs in your family can help you catch it early enough to beat it, maybe even prevent it. So why is there still a group of Minnesotans unable to unseal the secret?
It's not funny. Apparently we're having technical difficulties and that you're not seeing the video. You're seeing the PowerPoint presentation? I can see that.
Okay.
The audio should be plenty. I mean, we should be just fine.
Yeah. 11 states in addition to Minnesota are currently considering original birth certificate access legislation.
This wasn't about me going to a vague number of mother's sovereignty. This was about me finding out. Not the cancer, which I was in managing. I had to avoid any cancer. Right now, I'm hanging with the mind, and that's just those guilty things. The constant process is a triangle, first on the birth of the doctor, and the top of the triangle is the game plan. We never start a book from chapter 2. As a doctor, we live our lives from chapter 2. This is about the right of a human being to know the truth and the true story of the beginning of my existence. Everybody knows about the truth, but not me. That's all I want every adoptee to have, just to know where this story began. I want my book to be prepared from chapter 1, and not chapter 2.
Dale McDaniels is the lead performer for the group Run DMC. He is also an adoptee. He testified before the New Jersey legislators. He introduced the concept of a triad to illustrate the inclusion of adoptee, birth family, and adoptive family dynamics. New Jersey had labeled their legislation an adoptee birthright legislation. However, here in Minnesota, we feel strongly that the proposed legislation represents all perspectives of the triad and adds professionals as well. Our proposed legislation, the key features are that it revises current Minnesota law. It grants most adopted adults the right to receive their original birth certificate. It is considered compromised legislation. It balances the position of all triad members and professionals, and it is based on data collected from the Minnesota Department of Health. The outcomes that we are hoping our new legislation will bring forth is that it will approach equal access to the original birth certificate within the adoptee community. It approaches equivalence with the general population regarding birth certificates and fees and wait times, streamlines the existing process, it will conserve public funds, it allows the majority to prevail and the minority to be protected, restores human and moral rights of adoptees, and brings Minnesota adoption law into closer alignment with current best practices in adoption. This next slide is just a reminder that the H.R. 328 bill summary is in your information packet for you to see, and the effective date is August 1st of 2010. Yep.
Birth certificates serve many purposes, including establishing your proof of age, issuing passports, and dispensing of Social Security benefits. They are official vital records of the time and location of a person's birth and the name of their biological parents, and they are filed with the Minnesota Department of Health. In the case of adoption, there are two documents on file, both labeled birth certificates. The original birth certificate is issued for the adopted child when they are born. It is The amended is issued for an adopted child when the adoption is finalized. This does not happen in the foster care system. This is strictly adoption. It would display the child's new name, and their adoptive parents' names would then replace the birth parents' names on the birth certificate, and it becomes the adoptee's official use birth certificate. The original birth certificate is then placed in a sealed envelope at the Minnesota Department of Health when the adoption is finalized. The original is replaced with the amended birth certificate and a flag to indicate that another one exists, and it is no longer accessible by the adoptee or their adoptive family. This quote comes directly from the Minnesota Department of Health in regard to amending a birth record. I think it speaks to what a birth record really is, which is historical information. A birth certificate and all vital records are intended to accurately record the facts of a historical event. An amended birth certificate no longer meets this criteria. It is a reflection of who legally parented a person after an adoption process has been finalized. This is a timeline of Minnesota birth certificates in Minnesota. In 1858, when we became a state, all Minnesota birth records were public information. In 1917, Minnesota was the first state to make their adoptive birth certificates private. This was in the interest of the adoptee and the members of the triad. It was to maintain it for the parties of interest, which included the triad, to keep that from the eyes of their neighbors, not from each other. In 1939, adoptee birth certificates were sealed and became confidential, and they became inaccessible to the parties of interest, unless under court order. And then in 1977, Minnesota introduced the affidavit statute into the law, which changed how you could access that information.
Sheet of letter. Palenti said the birth mothers were promised their information would be kept confidential. I was never promised confidentiality. Sandy Spiraga gave up a baby in 1961.
There is no record that the intent of confidentiality was to protect birth mothers. No document has ever been found in any state that makes this promise.
In many cases, birth parents want contact with the child they've placed for adoption. Thousands have already filed what's called an affidavit of disclosure. We have information about that and much more on our website, byfox9.com. Click on the story, Unsealing the Secret.
An affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure is an official form filed by a birth parent. It states whether a birth parent wants the Department of Health to release the original birth certificate. It is legally binding and non-expiring unless rescinded by the birth parent. It becomes a part of the adoptee's permanent file at the Minnesota Department of Health, and it supersedes the wishes of the adoptee. These affidavits can be requested, notarized, and submitted anonymously to the Department of Health. We do have copies of the affidavits with us today, too, if you would like to see one or take copies with you. As this video clip illustrates, the public awareness campaign regarding the affidavit option.
Many of the women here are birth moms, the very people the governor is trying to protect. In his veto letter, he cited a Lutheran Social Services study which said 23% of birth moms did not want contact. This group paid the state health department to do a survey. It indicates that number might be much lower. And I would say the majority of the birth mothers are hoping and praying to meet their children or to know that they're alive and healthy.
The numbers displayed here were updated last week by the Minnesota Department of Health. They reflect the percentage of birth mothers preferring disclosure to non-disclosure is trending upward from 90 to 95%, which is on par with statistics in other states. You can refer to this list in your handout packet. We won't take time to review it now.
Here's the list of people and organizations that support this effort. This flowchart should look familiar to you. We've been distributing it for several weeks. We've included it here to remind you how complex the current process is and to illustrate the time and cost savings of the proposed process. It would eliminate mandatory multi-agency involvement. It eliminates the double standard for younger adult adoptees and older adult adoptees. And it reduces the need for case-by-case court involvement. This shows the streamlined process under our proposed law. You also have had a copy of that as well. This slide has been recently added to show you that we are moving toward parity in adoption. It does not guarantee full parity with the non-adoptee population. This was a difficult compromise, and that's what makes this compromise legislation.
We haven't had any problem with the parental notification plan. It's been a very successful program. There were a lot of people who threw up cost as an element why we shouldn't do this. It doesn't cost us anything.
I think the process has kind of proved that you know, it's really not that cumbersome.
I spoke to people in Colorado. They put a $200,000 a year price tag on this piece of legislation.
This is Lou D'Angelo, who's a state senator.
I have not seen the horror stories. We have not seen
and this is
the negative impact of this process.
In New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, we're the most frugal state in the United States, and we did it. We did it based on the $12 fee that we charge everybody else.
It's not going to be able to come with $95.
Tracing the illnesses suffered by your parents, grandparents, and other blood relatives
and tell
your
doctor
to make the disorders to which you may be at risk for and take action to keep you and your family healthy. Knowing your family's history can save your life.
Today, in fact, medical genetic testing, DNA testing, is able to provide persons, adopted persons, more complete information about their medical predisposition than the medical records of their birth parents.
There is no a single genetic test,
or
even a
third-party
genetic test, that allow an individual to retroactively determine what, in fact, their family might have been carrying.
Most genetic tests, whether it be for breast cancer or colon cancer or conditions like hemochromatosis, are pretty much predicated on whether or not there is a family history. The bottom line is that knowing your family history can save your life.
Again.
General says everything's good with the better with your family and talk about your health history. As an doctor, you can come to the table and got nothing.
This is a very tough coming to my family and my children. That's where I get upset, you know,
because
that's not fair.
This is a partial list of the health and medical organizations that support family history initiatives.
Despite the law, adoptees can pay adoption agencies to find their birth parents, but just ask Mindy. It's expensive. So you give us $600, and we'll start your search later. Well, I don't have to cut it. They can also go to court to show there's a medical need. Mindy tried that after her cancer diagnosis, because I asked her for my original birth certificate. My judge said no.
And those are some of the facts my dad got.
I am an advocate on the extended representative health and adoption institute. We work every day to help shape the best possible policy and law that is adopted based on research. Adoptees are not doctors, immigrants, or children who are searching for their moms and dads. And when we present that, we start to treat all our children, and we make assumptions that they're going to do something bad if they get information. There is
there's some available handouts here if anybody wants any more information in any one of the areas that we've touched on.
And just to recap what our bill will accomplish, it will move us toward parity and fairness, it will update the laws, and it will streamline the process.
We have one last time. This is David Allen, State Senator.
And one of the greatest days of her life was when she had the opportunity to come up. Shortly thereafter, she faced a medical situation. This ability to contact her mom had to be an extraordinary thing. My sister, I would like to know a little bit more of the hell to hell. I don't want to be a legislator who looks at Daryl or other kids and say, you know what, I know better than you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Representative Murphy, is that the end of the work? Trying to have some.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for having taken the time to listen to the presentation put together by the triad of people that are very interested in this legislation. I'd like to turn it over now to our guests who are going to be able to give you a little background and then answer your questions.
Okay, I'm just, some people are talking about having to leave, and I'm worried about trying to balance off time. That took quite a while. How many people want to testify on the other side of this bill? Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, I had emailed the committee administrator and asked for equal time. The nature of this particular issue is not one that you're going to find the people that oppose this coming down to the Capitol and showing their faces to testify against this bill. They do contact me. I have heard from them. I continue to hear from them. And there's been about 20 minutes of testimony from the proponents. There hasn't been any time for questions, and there's, 12 minutes left of the committee. So I'd be happy if you want to continue this to another time or whatever, but I do feel that I should be given the opportunity to present the other side of this issue in a fair and balanced manner.
And I agree, Representative Holmberg.
Mr. Chair, we can defer any further testimony.
Could, Representative Murphy, I think that would help, and because I think it's correct, Representative Holmberg should have the opportunity to present the case for the other side. And I think we'll have to stay after probably a little while just to do that. And maybe, Representative Holmberg, if you could do it now and then we can see if there's some time at the end of that for other questions and things like that. I'm not sure just how to handle that, but I think that's the way we'll try to do it. Is that... Oh, Representative Champion?
May I put forth a suggestion, Mr. Chair? Perhaps we can hear the balance if any other testimony from Representative Murphy and her testifiers, and I'm sure we'll then come close to the time that we will be adjourning, and then perhaps at the next gathering we can then have Representative Holmberg given the opportunity to present for a fluid 20 minutes or so, whatever constitutes a balance, and therefore any questions can be, you know, asked of Representative Murphy and her testifiers before they have to leave today, because I do have to go someplace else, but I want to be fair to Representative Holdberg to be able to have all the information and make an informed decision.
Well, one thing members should realize that committees are running over, and we're having to do that. I know just last Thursday, for instance, another committee went till 7:30 that was scheduled to 6:00. Representative Murphy, are these witnesses that could come back if we have to do that, or could we...
Mr. Chair, I'm looking to my witnesses. I'm looking to my witnesses. I know they live close by, but they have, as the rest of us do, full and busy lives.
Maybe, how long is their testimony? Maybe we could get, if it's short, we could do it quicker than going through this.
The testimony really depends on the questions that the members of the committee have.
Well, okay. Why don't we go ahead to Representative Holberg and then see what questions there are from the committee afterwards. I think that would be the best. Representative Holberg, would you want to go ahead and present the other side? Like you say, they don't want to come forward, so I guess you're... have to kind of do it for people that are unwilling to come forward.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate your willingness to provide the necessary time for this, and I'll try and work my way through this. This is an emotional issue, and one that I've worked on for a number of years. First of all, Representative Murphy started her testimony by talking about misinformation that was provided in the Health Committee. And what was said in the House Committee is that the U.S. Supreme Court had held a right for adoptees to their original birth certificates, and that's just not true. Certainly she said about a court case, but I think it's important that you know what was said in the House Committee that was not true. In fact, some of the House Committee members are still relying on as fact. I'm working through the issue. In your packet are a number of information sheets. They're all colored so that you'll be able to find them. But there's two testimonies from birth parents. There's also a testimony from concerned citizens. And also on the yellow sheet is a letter from Lutheran Social Services. If I might first correct some of the information, or if not a straight-out correction of additional information. There's conflicting data relative to the number of birth parents that want to have contact, and the number frequently used by the people that support this legislation is 90 to 95% of the people want disclosure, and what they're using for that data is percentage of affidavits of disclosure versus non-disclosure, which are really tied to the post-77 adoption situation, which is really very different than the pre-77. And most of my concerns are around the pre-77 adoptions. In the letter from Lutheran Social Services in the pre-77, where they go and they make the contact and ask because of the not having an affidavit on file, they consistently find about 24 to 25% of the birth parents that are contacted do not want their identities revealed, do not want the original birth certificates made public. And in talking to people that work with this, I think another thing, we use the term birth parent, but for the most part it's birth mothers. Even as the individuals that work this issue, it's even unusual, even in the 70s, to have birth fathers listed in the original birth certificate. So for the most part, we're talking about birth mothers, and I know they want to exclude birth fathers, but quite frankly, there are not very many of them listed in the birth certificates that I'm most concerned with. In the presentation, the people that support this bill talk about the cumbersome process of going through a search for birth parents in order to find out whether or not they can facilitate contact information or a medical history. And at least at Lutheran Social Services, they have a sliding fee. Many times they provide this service for free. If they have a current file, the amount is $250 as a set fee. A full search in which they don't have any information, the fee is $625. They haven't raised this fee in a long time. It doesn't cover their costs. And so what, in looking through this, one of the issues that we hear a lot, and in talking to members, they talk about the issue of medical history, and I can understand the need for a medical history, and what they stated around that whole issue is that in the case of medical histories, if a request is made for that, those are put to the top of the pile. They expedite those requests, and that if there's a medical emergency or medical information, they really work those. And again, the fee for that can be waived if it's a financial issue of the person requesting the information. It's unfortunate that the video wasn't as good as it could be in presenting the Channel 9 report, but I watched that more than once, actually. TiVo did, and watched it a couple times, and the whole premises of it was that Governor Plenty was standing in the way of people's medical information. Well, as I read this bill, there's nothing in this bill that is going to compel anybody to provide medical information. They still have to be willing to do it. Even the nature of the disclosure of an identity does not guarantee anybody their medical information if a birth parent does not want to provide it. And I think that I'll get to the privacy issue, but if the issue really is medical information through the court process, one of the ways in which that may be facilitated as a matter of public policy is changing the standard that a court would use in determining whether or not you could compel a birth parent to provide a medical history to adopt the absent the identity of the birth parent, if in fact that is the big compelling reason or interest for this bill. Now, what about the whole privacy issue? First of all, I think that it's only fair to talk to the committee a little bit. Most of you are younger than I am. I graduated from high school in 1977, the year that this law became an effect, where people were given the opportunity to sign an affidavit of disclosure and non-disclosure. Prior to that time, as you heard in our presentation, starting in 1939, adoption records were sealed. And you hear a lot of information around whether or not there was a right to privacy or a guarantee of privacy. Well, the records were sealed, and whether stated or implied, birth parents, at least the ones that are contacting me, felt that their identities would remain private unless they chose to change that standard. And so, what happened in those days? First of all, if you remember, abortion wasn't legal till the early 70s. The birth control pill didn't come into effect till the 60s. And believe it or not, people engaged in premarital sex for decades prior to that, and there were consequences. And it was not okay for single women to have children. It wasn't accepted. It put a stigma on them and their children. Women would not be able to hold certain occupations. They would not be able to attend certain schools. And in many, many instances, women left their communities, whether they went to an unwed home for women or went out on their own and found somebody to take them in another community. Many of these women gave these children for adoption and were told by professionals that were helping them, whether they be social workers or nurses or nuns, to go on with their life and not tell anybody about the situation. And many of them took that advice and counsel, went on to have families of their own, additional children, and never shared this secret with anyone. This bill before you today, if passed, if there's not a certificate of non-disclosure on file, the original birth certificate will become available to the adoptee. Whether that certificate was issued in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. In talking to Lutheran Social Services, when they do their search for birth parents, they have found women all over the world. This last year, they found a woman in Africa. No amount of public information campaign is going to be able to reach every one of those 25% of those women who are not in a position in their lives right now to want or have contact with their children that they gave up for adoption. So what does that mean? I heard more than once today testimony saying that this bill would move towards parity. Prior to 1977, when women had children in the state of Minnesota, those records were sealed, and they, most of them, believed that that was their right to have their privacy protected. Things change. I recognize that. I have adopted brothers. I have a close family member that gave a child up for adoption in the 70s. My parents were part of the foster care system, taking care of foster kids for 35 years, over 150 kids through our house. We saw firsthand the changes in society, the changes of women keeping their children, things becoming more acceptable. But I think that you have to review this bill through the lens of what was happening in the lives of these women in that different period of time. And I'm glad that in 77 the rules changed and made choices, and I'm glad for those adopted children. They have that process and can, it's a little easier for them to find birth parents if there's an affidavit or disclosure on file. But we cannot, as policymakers, view the situation of these birth parents that are generally older than me without looking through the lens of what the societal standards were during those periods of time. And the bill, when it's moving towards parity, that makes me nervous. The bill that was introduced last year would have made all birth certificates, even if there was a certificate of non-disclosure on file, available as if it could be proved that the birth parent had died. And so we've already seen a move of this group to undo the affidavit of non-disclosure that at the time was enacted in 77. Was supposedly a guarantee forever. And so my request to my fellow legislators, number one, because I hope you're not going to support the bill, I think that there are ways that we can get at the medical record issue more readily, but how long will it be if we do pass this bill? How long will it be before they'll be back in this very body again asking for a change in certificate of non-disclosures? We have a duty as legislators to uphold, again, whether stated or implied, the privacy of these birth mothers pre-77 and not make them subject because they couldn't figure out in a year's time, no matter where they lived, what their circumstances were, or if they were dead and weren't able to file a non-disclosure, that their identity is now available to the adoptee. And I just think that's wrong. And if we, again, if we need to deal with the medical record issue thing and what to deal with it and put a standard for the courts to determine relative to disclosing medical records, but I think I, for one, as a legislator, am going to fight like heck to make sure that the privacy of those birth parents pre-77 holds, and that we don't inadvertently turn their lives upside down because of our actions 30-some years later. And I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Representative Hartman, if we're to questions, there's already one on the list. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, the chart that you handed out, how many affidavits, it looks like there are some that there are no affidavits on file. Do we know the number?
Representative Murphy?
I mean, do we know, is there an assumption made by the department about that?
I'm sorry, hello, I'm Sarah Boswell-Healy. I'm an attorney here locally, and I have been assisting on this issue on a pro bono basis, and I was just pointing out the math on what was said earlier, but if we only have approximately 14,000 disclosures turned in either for or against disclosure, I think that leaves us just a little over 130,000 where there's nothing on file. But, you know, keep in mind, these go back a long time.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm trying to find out, because I voted against this bill last year, and agree with much of what, not everything, but what much of what Representative Holmberg is saying. And I've been lobbied by some constituents in my district and said I would take another look and read the chart. And I guess I'm trying to find out what the compromise is that should make someone like me, who is sort of sitting on the fence here, support the bill. It sounds like I thought, after talking to constituents, there was a compromise, and I don't quite get it.
Representative Murphy? I think you're asking Representative Murphy.
No, I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Representative Tamar, I believe the compromise to which you refer is the compromise that Mary Liz just laid out. So when the bill was introduced last year, it didn't recognize the continued filing of an affidavit of non-disclosure. That's the compromise, that we'll continue to recognize it. So there will be a continued protection for birth mother, birth parents on file.
I'm not sure I followed that, but I'm looking at your chart, and it does seem to say, it does seem to me, and again, I could be totally off here, that if you were a birth mother prior to 1977 and you filed a non-disclosure form, now you are going to, if I understand this correctly, the department will now make the form, the ability to petition available on their website. If the birth mother continues to say, I don't want contact, it sounds like that person could still petition the court.
Representative
Tamar,
that is the case. That's always been the case.
Representative Holberg had a point,
so that we can...
Mr. Chair, I think the only difference that I can tell in the bill is that they took away the when you die, no matter what, it becomes available part of it. So last year, the bill had, even if you sign a non-disclosure, once you were dead, it would be available to the adoptee. So that part's gone from the bill.
That's the only thing.
Representative
Tamar. To my knowledge.
Does somebody have their cell phone on? Doesn't matter if it's not on ring, it's still... If it's on at all, it affects our systems here. Go ahead, Representative Murphy. Ms. Blaisner?
Correct. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our bill last year, Representative Holbert, the change we're referring to is we've been lobbying for this for several years. A few years ago, had a compact preference form in place, which would have required that the birth parent determine whether they wanted contact, they didn't want contact, or they wanted contact through an intermediary. Then that would guide the process, but the adoptee would get their birth certificate. After consultation with two of the other agencies, child placing agencies in the area, we met, we worked things out, we came to a compromise, which was honoring the affidavit of non-disclosure. Those will not be released. And that there are the two other agencies in the area that are either neutral on this or have supported us. We've spent numerous time coming around, and that's the compromise that we have come to. Is we are compromising and honoring those affidavits of non-disclosure. We are those small percentage of people that do not want contact. We're honoring that system that's currently in place.
I'm confused.
Representative, do you want to ask Representative Holberg? Representative Holberg.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and I have a question for the testifier, but I think Representative Tamar, they haven't addressed the issue of the pre-77 that haven't had an opportunity, nor do they know that they'd have to file a non-disclosure. They're going to do a one-year advertising campaign. But my question is if, in fact, they're pre-77 and they're dead, unable to file a non-disclosure, will those birth certificates be available to the adoptee?
No.
Ms. Blaisner?
They will not.
And Madam Chair, where does that say that in your bill?
Ms. Blaisner?
Currently, adoption law, and the lawyers would probably be better to say this, but currently it stands at 100 years. Their fields or birth records are, I think, 100 years. In a previous bill, we had added language that we would that they would be disclosed if you could, if the birth parent were deceased. We've taken that language out this year. It's not in there. It was an amendment, I believe.
I'm going to come back to your representative.
I'm fine for now. Let some other people ask.
Mr. Chair, your bill says that if you do not have an affidavit of non-disclosure on file, then the birth certificate is available to the adoptee. So if they go to get their record, there's no matching of death certificates and adoption original birth certificates anywhere. So if the birth mother is dead, never knows the lodgings because they're 6 feet under, they don't fill in an affidavit of non-disclosure, and their adopted child, their natural born child, comes and asks for the adoption record, the pre-77 original birth certificate, and there's no affidavit of non-disclosure on file, won't they be able to get that?
Ms. Blaisner.
Yes, but with all due respect, the secret, if it's the birth mother and she's deceased, then I don't understand how a deceased person would overrule the rights of someone who is still living and perhaps needed that information.
Well, and
I'm not certain.
Mr. Chair, that's my point. Is if the birth mother went on to have their life and never told their new spouse or their children or anybody in their life about the existence of this child, they are no longer with us. The information is available. The adopted child goes looking, finds out that their birth mother is dead, but finds out there's a surviving spouse and half siblings, etc. The birth mother isn't around to explain what happened, to answer any questions. She took that secret to her grave with her, and who are we to undo that?
Representative Tamar, are you, or can we, Representative Hortman's next on the list. Thanks. Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, before Representative Hortman speaks.
Murphy.
I think that it's important that the reason that we're moving this legislation forward is to provide equity in terms of access to a birth record, a historical record. And I know that this is extremely sensitive, and I know that we're asking you to consider changing what some feel was a promise made before 1977. But I want to go back to the beginning of Representative Holder's testimony, because she made reference to what I said in Health and Human Services policy, and I want to make sure I read this to you, because I don't want to read from the letter now, I'm going to read from the court. Number 306 is to establish fair and reasonable procedures for the adoption of children and to provide for the well-being of the child with full recognition of the independent needs and interests of the biological parents and the adoptive parents. However, when the interests of the child and an adult are in conflict, the conflict must be resolved in favor of the child. That's what I brought up in Health and Human Services. I want to make sure that my words are being clearly relayed to you. I said that it came from the U.S. Supreme Court, it came from the South Carolina Supreme Court, but I think that the policy embodied in that statement is important for the committee to consider, because we can make this very much about secrets, keeping secrets, not keeping secrets. I want to plead with you that this is really about access to a historical record on the behalf of adult adopted children. And I know you were going to turn to Representative Portman.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a question of probably both Representative Murphy and Representative Holberg. And that is, the way I read the bill, if an adopted child gets access to the information, it's only that person who has access to the information. It doesn't make the birth record public, right? And so the issue of the spouse of the birth mother or the other children of the birth mother finding out about the adopted person would depend upon whether or not the adopted person then goes and contacts those people against the birth mother's will or in the case where she's deceased. Is that, am I reading it right, that it's the release is only to the person who is named on the birth certificate?
Correct. Representative Hortman, that's correct.
Representative Holbert.
Well, and Mr. Chair, the release to the public comes at the point that the child reaches the age of 100. So there is a historical document 100 years later. That's when the original birth certificate becomes public. But you are correct, but we don't have, some states have put into law prohibitions of contact of other family members, so that, in other words, so that if a adoptee were to get the birth certificate and find out that their birth parent was deceased, the state law actually prohibits contact of other family members. That, you know, that's one way that it's dealt with in other states.
Can I ask
Hortman,
a follow-up question about that 100-year point, because I'm not sure if that was in the bill or if that's just current law. Is this a change that we would be making, or is it current law that after 100 years, your birth certificate is public?
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, it's current law.
It's current law. So no matter what, right now, after 100 years, your birth certificate is public. And this proposed law wouldn't change anything about that.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, no.
And Representative Murphy, do you disagree or agree?
Mr. Chair, I agree. Oh. And before we move forward, I'm wondering if we could just turn to Professor Stinson, who's here, to share just a little bit of information with you about the issue of privacy, just to counter some of what you've heard.
Oh, okay. What's your name?
My name is Mike Stinson, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law.
Stinson?
Stinson, oh. Yes, S-T-E-N-S-O-N, I teach constitutional law and other courses. And I will be really brief, and I would prefer just to ask questions. I know you're running late on time. I think it would be impossible to give an absolutely definitive conclusion as to the constitutionality of the bill. The question is, how would the Minnesota Supreme Court, Federal District Court in Minnesota, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, potentially the United States Supreme Court, resolve potential challenges to the bill? Challenges would be based upon invasion of privacy, including the right to personal autonomy, a right to informational privacy, and an argument that the bill as proposed would violate the contract clause of Minnesota and federal constitutions, Article 1, Section 10 of the federal constitution, Article 1, Section 11 of the Minnesota constitution, which simply states that states shall not enact laws impairing contractual obligations. It's very difficult to talk about privacy in a broad sense. Are there privacy rights that birth mothers have? And of course the answer is yes, they have rights. But from the constitutional standpoint, the issue is whether or not those privacy interests rise to the level of fundamental constitutional rights. Now, the way the system works when there are constitutional challenges is that courts, during those challenges, whether under either the federal constitution or the Minnesota constitution, apply essentially a rational basis standard. And what that does is to ensure that courts defer, in most cases, to the legislative judgment. So the kinds of questions that you're considering now are fought out in this forum and not in the courts. Now, sometimes there are fundamental federal constitutional rights that might be asserted in the federal court or the Minnesota Supreme Court. Applying the Minnesota Constitution might say, well, this is an issue that we're going to take away from the legislature. This right is so important that no legislative judgment can interfere with that right. Well, it's extremely rare for courts to take that position. Talking about general rights of personal autonomy doesn't really help, because fundamental constitutional rights have to be defined with some degree of particularity. There is, in a general sense, a right to personal autonomy, but not a right that would be recognized as a fundamental right. And it really becomes important for purposes of constitutional review to determine what kind of right courts are dealing with. If it's fundamental, courts are going to take a harder look at the legislative judgment underlying that law. The legislative burden is going to be significantly greater in order for that law to be sustained. So if, whether under the federal constitution, for example, or the Minnesota constitution, we were dealing with a right recognized as fundamental, the court might apply a standard called strict scrutiny. Now that means that you'd have to have something more than just a rational basis for the legislation that you enact. You'd have to have a compelling governmental interest. It makes it more difficult, but certainly not impossible, to sustain the constitutionality of the legislation. So, two really, really critical points here. Number one, not all rights are constitutional rights. Those rights have to be defined with some particularity. And point number two, simply because a right is, in fact, a recognized constitutional right, doesn't mean that a court wouldn't engage in a balancing process to determine if the legislative reasons are sufficient to override that constitutional right. All right, so the rights that would be asserted would be a right to, in the situation, and these are the rights that have been asserted in the decided cases in both Tennessee and Oregon, a right to familial privacy. Well, the right to familial privacy certainly doesn't relate to adoption. The right to give a child up for adoption, the right to be adopted, has never been held by federal courts, state Supreme Courts, to be a fundamental constitutional right. There really is no right to familial privacy. This bill doesn't interfere with a woman's decision whether or not to give a child up for adoption. It sometimes has been related to the right to reproductive autonomy, and I'm sure you're all familiar with that, Roe versus Wade, the right to abortion, and so on. Well, this bill doesn't come remotely close to interfering with the right to reproductive autonomy. It's simply a non-issue. And again, the court is deciding this case, the Tennessee Supreme Court under the Tennessee Constitution, the Oregon Supreme Court under the Oregon federal constitutions, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals under the federal constitution, looking at Tennessee's adoption disclosure law, have all found that there is no invasion of privacy. So to make what could be a very long story very short, there's no fundamental right to privacy that's violated under these circumstances. But be sure that you understand that we're not talking about broad privacy rights of personal autonomy. Those rights have to be defined specifically. My assessment is that there is no violation in this case. Whether the Minnesota Constitution or the federal constitution is involved, there would be no privacy right violated. I don't think that the contract impairment clause applies, and I don't think that there's an equal protection claim. And maybe I'll just simply leave it at that and see if there are any questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wonder, given the fact that it's 6:25 and we're already missing like four members of the committee, if we could table this bill until the next committee gathering when we have a full committee and we could further explore. Because I think, unfortunately, the law professor's testimony actually raises more questions than it answers with regard to our obligation not to be enacting laws that are unconstitutional. And we just really barely dived into this topic, and yet we're already 25 minutes after, so I just would suggest that it might be appropriate to lay the bill on the table.
Representative Hortman, I think we should go ahead on this. We've got quite a bit of bills coming into us, and we have a majority of the committee here now. Representative Paymar?
Well, I don't. You know, you can just do what you want to do here. I don't feel like I have all the information, but I could, I guess, wait to it as it goes through the process. I don't feel very comfortable for having it all my questions answered. But
Representative Holbrook, you had your hand up.
Well, I think that, you know, we've only heard one side of the court case, and I certainly, from everything I have read, I would agree with the statements, but I don't think that any court has held either that an adoptee has a guaranteed right to the original birth certificate either. But from, you know, what I've been, I'm a non-attorney, so I've been having people, you know, help me with this information and trying to sort it all out. But it's, it appears that it's definitely an issue for the states to determine at this point, to balance the different needs. But as far as my understanding, as far as if you hold it over, that you got a medical marijuana on Wednesday morning is my understanding. I could be here. I have something in my district, or if you were going to hold it over till Wednesday, I could be here, but I'm guessing you already have a pretty full day for that meeting as well.
Can I ask one more question? Real brief, after, and then I'd be ready to vote.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, and then I'll...
There were some references to numbers earlier of 100,000. Are we talking 100,000 people's lives that are going to be affected by this bill, or 100,000 adoptions or better prior to 1977, I think it is?
Ms. Blaisner, or...
Or I could even ask it this way. How many requests per year of pre-77 birth certificates are there?
Ms. Blaisner, I think.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, when the Minnesota Department of Health did the audit for us, unfortunately, they did not break it down by years. So I couldn't tell you with certainty how many affidavits were filed per year. But keep in mind that that large number of 145,000 includes any amended any birth certificate. So that could amended. That could be international adoption. That could be a step-parent adoption. That could be from all of time. So that is a large number, but it's including not just domestic adoption.
Representative Tamar?
Mr. Chair, so I'm just sorry for this. I have Representative Murphy. So prior to 1977, did a birth mother would fill out an affidavit of non-disclosure? It never happened.
No.
Okay, so now they would be required to under this bill if they wanted their circumstances to remain
Representative
private.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tamar. After 1977, they were required to fill out an affidavit of non-disclosure.
Okay, so I see. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Tamar, the pre-77, they don't know. Unless they know the law changes, and they have until August 1st of 2010 to do this, and they're scattered across the country and across the world, they would not know that the legislature had totally flipped on its head what they thought relative to access to the information. And so, that's why I think it's really important to be able to differentiate between pre and post 77 as far as the number of disclosures, et cetera. So it's one thing if you have a choice up front. It's another if you don't know all the rules change and get a 180 on you.
Thank you.
Representative Tamar, did you have a follow-up? Or Representative Holland?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think Representative Holberg answered my question somewhat. But just for any one of you that wants to answer, as I'm reading them, anybody before 1977 could get the shock of their life to all of a sudden find out somebody's out to want to know something that they thought they in goodwill would never have to reveal.
I'm sorry, could I just answer that? I've done a lot of research on this. And I would tell you that it is never, a woman who's given a child up for adoption, it's never going to be the shock of their life that child is still out there wondering information about their background. Also, if a secret is going to be kept, people are pretty good at keeping their secrets. They're going to know what the law is, and they're going to try and change it or be involved in filing that affidavit of non-disclosure. And then finally, I think it just bears mentioning that these people did not have that legal privacy right that keeps being implied in these discussions. They had a desire to keep secrets, but it's not the same thing as an actual legal right to privacy in this information.
Representative Olin, follow up.
Thank you for your comment, but what I will tell you is the comment and the way it was addressed has made up my mind for me. Because to have somebody 31 years later expect that all of a sudden somebody is going to come along with this question is not what I would expect, and I would be totally shocked 31 years later.
And okay. Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Holt.
But I don't think the shock we're talking about is that a child would be looking for the mother. The shock would be that the mother, having 30, 40, or 50 years ago, being told, whether it was a constitutional right or not, implied or stated, they were told that this would remain secret, and they rely on that. And for that to just be totally turned upside down, let alone the impact for those that have passed on, I don't feel that it's the right thing to do to change our public policy 31 years later.
I guess to clarify, I don't mean someone's going to show up on somebody's doorstep, and I just think it's about, it's not about somebody showing up on a doorstep and giving the shock of a lifetime. It's about just opening up a little more information for the adoptees.
Representative Olin, a follow-up?
Yeah, just for the record, when I said shock of life, I wasn't referring to a total shock at the doorstep. What I was referring to when the laws passed it, when I acted under what was a law and find out 31 years later it no longer is, that's to me a shock.
Mr. Chair, that point, and I understand Representative Olin that this is, we are contemplating a change of policy. That's what we're doing here. Current law, if there's an affidavit of non-disclosure, an adoptee can go to court. Pre-1977, when there was no affidavit of non-disclosure, an adoptee could go to court. So that the idea that there was an absolute promise, one, not supported in our past, but two, there was always a means for an adoptee to get access to their birth record. We know that adoptees who get access to their birth record often stop there. They don't pursue follow-up. They want access to the record. They want equality, the same as children that are raised in their birth families. And that's what this is about.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I'm willing to vote to move this bill on to the next committee. I'm still troubled by parts of it and would like, I just want to let that, I want you to know that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Tamar, I am happy, as are those that are with me, to help resolve those qualms. And if there are things that we can do with language to make that better, I'm more than happy to work with you. I've taken this on this year. I'm not for the compromises that happened last year, but I'm happy to work with you to make the compromises necessary to pass this law to give equity and access to adoptees. Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much for your tolerance and indulgence.
We're ready to vote, Representative Murphy, and Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 328 and refer it to the Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
I believe it carries.
Division.
Division, okay. There's no applause in this room.
Mr. Chair, for division.
Representative Holberg, I was going to do that, but there was a little interlude. All in favor, raise your hand. Opposed, raise your hand.
Thank you.
I think it carries by quite a bit. Chair was right. The bill carries. It is passed on to the Finance Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And we are now adjourned.